Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Swim Podcast.
Welcome to Swim Podcast, episode number 8. The someone who isn't me is author, composer, musician, and frontman for Killing Joke, Mr. Jazz Coleman. And I knew that speaking with him would be like make for a fascinating interview, and we cover topics like punk rock and mysticism and ecology and magic and politics and performance. But it shoots off on tangents, and I should point out that this is the first interview where my I don't want to sound like a crazy person filter was totally disengaged. So if at any point you think that I sound like a crazy person, that'll be why. The book that I keep referring to is Jazz's book called Letters from Cythera, which if this podcast interests you, you should definitely like look at picking up because it's amazing. I'm still going through it along with a few other things as well at the moment, but it's an incredible and multifaceted read, much like the man who wrote it. So without further ado, Jazz Coleman.
When I knew that this was going to happen, I was really happy in it, and it's come around quicker than I thought it would as well because I wanted to get through the book. And then as soon as I started reading it, I realised I wasn't going to for quite some time.
No.
And I don't mean that in any way to have like a sound.
No, it's
derogatory.
Not. You can't speed read it, no.
No. Yeah, so, and there's so much to cover. So I guess if we start talking about the band first and then see where we end up.
Sure.
Something that I wanted to say straight off the bat is that all of these that I've done so far, I have a very definite view of where music and art comes from. Each of these podcasts, it generally gets to sort of 2/3 of the way through, and then we start to touch on that, and most of the people so far have agreed that I think that it is something that when you are making art, be it music, visual art, I believe that you're projecting things that aren't necessarily just from an internal source.
Sure, I agree with you. You're downloading from a cosmic source.
Yes.
Yes.
And that generally comes about in 2/3 of the way through in all the other ones. And I always worry because I think people are going to look at me like I'm bonkers. But I feel that we
you look a bit mad. It's a bit
exactly.
Touchy, right?
But I think it's this, like I've been living in the woods making pipe bombs. But
that's
I feel
pretty good, that. That's quite accurate. Yeah.
I figured we could probably get into that quite quickly. Because when you started the band, like, you know, just going through the book, I found it really interesting that very quickly that it came about that when there were the two of you and then you decided you needed to get other members of the band, the way in which you went about it was incredible through an ad in the NME and a magic ritual.
That's right. You know, well, the funny thing was, I'm remembering my early conversations with Big Paul. I'd been hanging out with him and living with him for quite a long time, and we looked at the problem of how the hell were we going to find two other guys who sort of shared our sort of political anarchic outlook and had a sort of revolutionary approach to their instruments, and similarly had a sort of esoteric slant. Now here's the thing, I didn't really know where Big Paul was coming from until I said to him, look, it's a tall order. How are we going to get these kind of qualities in two other people, and how the hell are we going to find them? And Paul was the one who said, magic. We're going to do it by magic. And up until that moment in time, I hadn't really told Paul of my involvement in the occult. And he hadn't told me of his involvement in the occult. So that was like, we've got a lot to talk about from that moment onwards, you know. And from that moment, Actually, that must have been about... that must have been... I'm just trying to think of the year. That must have been around about early summertime, May, maybe earlier than that, of 1978, maybe even earlier than that, that we had that conversation. And as soon as we agreed on the principle, Paul was very adamant that we should study for about 4 months in preparation for the ritual, which is what we did. Yeah. And in that time, we really, really studied, you know, the Rosicrucian Golden Dawn system of magic, took what we could from it and applied what we could to, lifted what we wanted to take and applied it to our own purposes. Of course, I don't know what everyone's aware of, when we actually did the ritual, you know, I took the compass points of the circle from the church down the road, not having a compass, and I got the cardinal points wrong, so our east was actually south. Okay. And if anyone's aware of the station of the south, south is where Set or Shaitan or, and all these kind of energies, Prometheus, come from the south, and that in effect is what we invoked and what has stayed with us all these years, and it has sustained us, I may add.
I think so as well. As a band coming out in that era as well, that was aside from what you were doing musically being such its own thing, but I think that's probably, you know, music is the sum of the parts involved. And
what frustrated me about music at that time, because I loved the first wave of punk and the energy from this.
Yeah.
And then I loved the kind of second wave of punk with the punky reggae party thing that Marley kind of brought to the equation and the reggae bass lines. But then there was something still really missing for me, and it wasn't until Killing Joke and Joy Division that we really started to address that. And that was the element of mysticism in, yes, music, which was kind of anathema to punks at the time, to have any element of mysticism. And it's something that we embraced. And I know that Ian Curtis also embraced it too. Hmm. And so there was this small pocket of the third wave of punk, as I should call it, which was Public Image Limited, Killing Joke and Joy Division, I think were key members, players in that movement. We took the mystical thing, I think, in the third wave of punk, and we ran with it. And we still are, because there is something mystical about Killing Joke when you hear it. It might surprise people, but I'm a huge fan of Killing Joke. If I wasn't in the band, I would love Killing Joke. I mean, I adore them as a band. I actually am separate from this band. I can be outside of this band and say, that band I really like. They are sincere. That's my favourite band. Then I find I'm actually in the band.
Yeah.
It's this kind of strange relationship. I think we all have that relationship with Killing Joke, in Killing Joke, as it were. We stand outside of it, and it's something that we worship. Yeah. It's something that we adore. It's like the first four lines of Schiller's Ode to Joy. It's a sacred place, you know. And of course, there's been so many times in our career where there's no money at all. But everybody comes to the table. There's this fire that drives us together, and
literally,
and, and it's so much part of our lives. You see. For you to understand how we view Killing Joke is the medium that gave us everything. It nourished our lives. Killing Joke was our university, our way into the business, our everything. It became our university. I mean, I thought all bands were like our band. I thought that everybody swapped books and had debates and talks about the esoteric and Big Brother and the political system and the rise of corporations. I thought all bands did this, but I found that they don't. And actually, when I've looked at other bands over the years, I realised I couldn't be in any other group but Killing Joke. They all bore me to tears. I'd have nothing in common with any of these musicians, as it were. I mean, there's no common ground. Maybe Jimmy Page. Maybe that's about it.
Most definitely Jimmy Page. That's something. I thought this would be bouncing around as far as things that get mentioned. Something I heard. I mean, you don't have to. If it's not true, then it's not true. And if it is true, you don't have to comment on it if you don't want to. But I heard that you were one of the few people that Jimmy Page gave access to his collection, his book collection. And he has an incredible collection of...
I think outside of the Vatican, it's one of the best collections in the world.
Really?
you know, I think the Rothschilds have got a big occult collection. But I mean, I think, no, sincerely.
Yeah.
But I think ever since I've known Jimmy, and when I started my career, Jimmy had a bookshop called the Equinox just off Kenny High Street. And that had just closed. In fact, Youth went round there when he was tripping off his head trying to squat the place, I think, one time. But Jimmy was very much a collector then. And back in about 78, 79, I used to go to different bookshops and try and get first editions and find first editions that I could sell to Jimmy, because he was a collector of first editions. And, like, yes, his collection is just something else. If anybody's interested in occult books, I don't think... I mean, what can I say? I remember the time I first went into the library, Jimmy was moving everything around, and it's this huge, huge, huge room, and all the books were piled up about 4 foot high, and I remember finding the original copy of the Book of the Law just lying there on one of these piles, you know. Yeah. And quite a few other huge occult masterpieces that he's got in there. And I spent all day there. And it was a remarkable time. But I can't really talk about how Killing Joke met members of Led Zeppelin. I can't talk about that.
Okay.
Because it's a very strange circumstances.
But strange circumstances occur when like-minded people are I was going to say not drawn together, but it's almost like things happen to make situations occur. Is it one of those type of things? You don't need to
talk about that. I mean, you know, the time I met Led Zeppelin and some members of the Stones, how shall I put this? There were members of lower members of the royal family and all sorts of people that were around then, and you just wouldn't believe it, but I can't really talk about it that period. But I have a great affection for Jimmy. I consider him like my spiritual father in some ways, because he's trodden the path that I'm following in some ways, You know, here we are in our modern world, and you know, the orthodox interpreters of the spirit. That I think, generally speaking, they've failed mankind as orthodox interpreters of the human spirit, and so it's been left to our generation to find some sort of spiritual compass, as it were, and that's been a huge journey to find out what is true, what is false. And some of the paths that I've followed, I've looked at some of, you know, when we look at people like Aleister Crowley, for example, would you let this person babysit your children? You know, we have these kind of areas that we go into from time to time. But I think everything that's come from that direction has quite a solid foundation. The law I'm talking about.
Yes.
And I kind of interpret it in my own way. I think the law, and if anybody knows what I'm talking about when I refer to the law, the idea of do what thou wilt, I think it's something sacred and holy. And I believe that everybody is born with a God gift, you see, and that life is the location of your God gift and the selfless execution of it. And that's what I think. I call it your one's true will. And I think... it's something very sacred, you see, and I try to tell people that have lost their confidence in life that they have a God gift, and the most important thing is to find it, and when you find it and you exercise your God gift, you are spiritually and biologically in harmony with the universe. In my particular
I agree.
Outlook, if you like, you know. Yeah. So it's something sacred to me, the law, and I've seen people and other schools interpret it in all sorts of different ways, and sometimes in a very seedy fashion, and it kind of upsets me, because I think it's something beautiful and holy, essentially.
And would you say that people have lost their bearing on that sense, so they need a compass and to find their way back to that way of thinking and that way of living, and that Crowley was definitely one of those teachers. Are there others that you look in the same, like Speer, for example?
With Speer, obviously. But also Carl Jung is a huge influence on my life. I mean, what's the magical tradition called location of one's holy guardian angel. Jung referred to this as individuation, which is basically the location of your unconscious personality that each and every one of us has. And of course it's a different personality to your conscious personality. And it's familiarizing yourself with that aspect of yourself. For example, I went through this process in 1982. That's why I went off to Iceland, a most misunderstood period. And if I hadn't gone to Iceland, I don't think I'd have ever been a composer. I think I would have honestly got another 25, possibly 30 years without having that singular thought that I want to be a composer for symphony orchestra. And that came the day that I got to Iceland, the day I arrived on 26th of February, 1982.
Which is a really resonant date for you, isn't it?
It is a resonant date, because it's the date I started Killing Joke. And it's the date that traditionally in the United Kingdom we plant seeds in terms of the calendrical cycle. So I see it's always an important day for me. And of course, I felt that it was right that I to a degree, an aspect of myself, I would personify Killing Joke by making that, if you like, one of our holy days. And it is, because it's the day that Paul and myself invoked the force of Killing Joke, which has stayed with us all these years and sustained us 38 years. 38 years.
When a young person is starting a band, there's no concept of that, is there?
No concept of it. I mean, I can remember after being in Killing Joke, 4 years feeling like it ancient, that we've been going on for ages and ages and ages. You know, by the time we reached our third album, I felt the band was ancient.
Did you feel like there was going to be, when you first started it, was there like an agenda where you saw it, that we're going to go to here, that we're going to achieve this and this, and that's it, then we're done?
That's a very interesting point. I don't suppose at any stage in my career I've ever thought of the day when we're not together. Actually, when I think about it now, I can't think there's any time I've thought, oh yeah, well, when the band breaks up and I go off and do that. I've never ever thought about that. You know, there's been times when Killing Joke has been sort of, for a short time, taken away from me. Like Iceland was one of them, when I kind of gave up Killing Joke for a while because I had to do this individuation thing. And then there was another period where I was actually fired from Killing Joke, if you look back at the history. And at those times, you know, you just have to kind of let go, and you realise that actually, how can you not be part of Killing Joke when it's in your soul? It's quite ridiculous, really. But yeah. I've had to let go at different times, just think, well, maybe it won't happen again. But when I met the guys, the feeling was is that, and even when Paul left, that I knew he would come back, and I knew we would all face the last battle together, as it were. You know,
it's so incredible that the band has such a long history, and. You know, you achieved so many things that at that time when people, and now, people would start a band and go, well, we need to do this, and we need to have this kind of, we need to have a hit, we need to travel the world, and we need to play shows to this many people. And it's almost like a checklist. It gets to the point where, and it can be a huge source of frustration for a lot of people, I think, because they're not cut out for it. But the thing that I find amazing is that with the band's long history, you've done all those things.
Youth was a big force in reaching all the milestones. When you're in a band and you do your first New York show and this kind of thing, Youth was always the one who's going, come on, we have to do this and we have to do that. You know, he was always everyone's got their role in Killing Joke. Most people don't realise that Geordie's always looked after the equipment, and he pushes roadies out of the way, and he gets his toolkit, and he mends everything himself. And right from the beginning, he used to fix my keyboards and all the amps. And that was his role. My kind of role was hustling. Everyone's got different roles. Paul's was to look after the accounts, and Youth's role was also hustling. So we had the two rats that did all the hustling. Yeah. Everyone's got their kind of roles, and it's still the same today. You know, Geordie gets pissed off with the roadies. He gets his toolkit out, pushes him out of the way, and fixes it himself. Still, you know.
Well, that's the thing. It's like that is. I mean that's the epitome of what punk rock should have been. For a start, it's taking the reins, and the idea of of people fulfilling these separate roles wasn't necessarily there, but and that's probably why bands haven't.
Hey, look, I can remember when I was 19 and the band living in the squat. I remember trying to write one day everything I felt and realizing that my command over the English language was really quite appalling. Because, you know, I left school at 15, and so I didn't really complete my basic high school education. So, like, Killing Joke became the sort of school. It's the invisible college, I refer to it as, you know, because that's exactly what it's been for all of us. You know, when you think of Killing Joke's first record, that we produced it ourselves, and we wouldn't even entertain the idea of another producer. You know, and so we were learning skills all the time, and we were just hungry to learn all the skills ourselves so we could do everything ourselves. I mean, you just don't see this in bands these days, you know. And the Renaissance principle of, you know, people like youth who like literature, poetry, and, well, all the band, and have just got a broad interest from esoteric to, well, you know, world events and geopolitics and this. I mean, they're very, very interesting individuals in the band. And we actually, of course, I realize it now, we actually have so much in common. You only realize it when you look at other bands, really.
Yeah.
How much you've got in common. I haven't seen the guys in the band this year. And I can tell you, I will be seeing them somewhere around about 24th of May. And I'm really missing them all. And they're the best company. And when I think of this world, my world now, and I think of company, like, those guys that make me laugh my head off, they are actually my best friends. But you don't get an easy time with them. It's the kind of friendship where everybody turns on each other and they won't hold back on weak points and... like, it's very challenging, very trying, being in Killing Joke. It's not straightforward. Doing an album in Killing, any album, is the most traumatic thing you can. You have to take a huge, deep breath in. It's incredibly traumatic for everybody. I don't know why it has to be like that. I wish it wasn't, actually, but it is every fucking time.
But then that's almost like a... looking at it in a ritualistic way, maybe the cathartic means to make great art, perhaps. Maybe that's why it is such a challenge. Maybe that friction
it's absolutely friction is the things that we don't agree on that make the music how it is, not the things we agree on. Sure it is. And there's an energy between the four of us that when it locks in something. I remember the first jam, it was like this. The first jam, when it really locked in, it was like the universe opened. And everybody who walks into the room, because loads of external people walked into the room and saw Killing Joke's first rehearsal, when it really locked in, and it was like the universe opened. Like I said, it was the most exhilarating experience of my life. All of us. It just, when the four of us get together, that's that weird chemistry thing. I guess it must be the same with Pink Floyd or any of the big bands or whatever. Something happens. Now, you can change one person and it doesn't happen the same way, quite the same way. I mean, there's no disrespect to my bass player, because Youth's the most original bass player in the world, but it would be easier with any other bass player in the world, but it wouldn't be the same. You know, Youth's done all the wrong things all his career and it works. And here's a guy who's got an amazing sound just by virtue of his own limitations. You know, and using it for his benefit, and it just works. I don't ask me why. Sometimes it's not even in tune, but it still works. It's one of those funny things, those weird chemistry things. And all I can say to artists out there, once they find a really magic chemistry with someone else, is stay together, keep that musical friendship going for as long as possible, because it's such a rare thing. It's so precious,
and it would be a rare thing as well that you would achieve the maximum that you could within those first few sort of founding sort of steps anyway with the band.
Now everything seems so precious. I mean, I was listening to some program a couple of months ago, and it was some American survey where they discovered that basically rock musicians live on average about 25 years less than other normal mortals, and so it made me think how precious Killing Joke is, and like Geordie, they just don't make people like Geordie anywhere in the world. I mean, you get people like Jimmy Page and some of the greatest musicians on the planet. They don't know how Geordie does it. This guy who's just he's a humble person, Geordie, but I think he's the greatest living guitarist on the planet, in my personal opinion. See him while you can. I think Jimi Hendrix would be in the front row with his mouth open if he saw Geordie play.
Is that because, going back to when you were getting the band first together?
Mm. Well, Geordie hadn't played with a band before, Killing Joke.
Yeah, that's something that blew my mind in the book.
Yeah, yeah. He never played with a band. He never played with bass or drums before. Yeah. Before Youth and Big Paul.
But I saw that you were looking to collaborate with others, and probably quoting this very badly from the book, but you said that can channel primeval and elemental forces.
Sure.
Which is not what most people look for when they're first starting a band, but that is what I think is the case. And that's why the band is what it is.
It's funny, Big Paul was looking for this as well. Mm. He the sound of the earth growing up was one of Paul's references. You know, we were looking for the same thing. It's one of those strange things. I have to be honest, I believe I've reincarnated with the rest of the band. As I'm part Indian origin, the idea of the transmigration of the soul is a fact of life for me. But I guess Caucasians and Western people have a problem with it. But I feel I incarnated with the guys, and I would have met them under any circumstances, and that we're meant to live our lives together now. We're all meant to be together in this incarnation. I feel that very, very strongly with Killing Joke. Yeah. I felt it from the second I met Paul Ferguson and I met the rest of the guys. They are my spiritual brothers. And for better or for worse, we're in this together.
Yeah. I think it's interesting as well that the band that were kind of born out of an era when it was like, it was such a like an awful point. I remember growing up as a kid and being in school and watching films about the imminent nuclear war and what's going to happen.
Go. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because it was, and it just was such a, you know, everyone talks now that it's like, oh, it's terrible now. We're living in a climate of fear. The news, the media, everybody's pumping you just full of fear, 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 so that you can be controlled. And that is true, I believe.
It is strategies of sustained tension, I believe they call them.
That's a much more eloquent way of putting it.
Yes, but, that is what is happening now. It's true, yes. But, I mean, the guy who was behind this was a guy called Kurt Lewin, who started the Tavistock Institute, and he said basically, if we subject a population to fear all the time, we bombard them with shocks. They revert to a tabula rasa, which means a blank slate, as it were, and they revert to a childlike mindset in which they're more malleable and easier to manipulate, as it, you know, and that's basically since 9/11 what I believe is happening. This is basically all arranged by think tanks to keep people in this perpetual state of anxiety.
But don't you feel that that's been going since long before recent events? I mean, it just seems to
well,
have
yes,
ramped
yes,
up.
Yes, it
just
it seems ha- of to course have it has done. But it's been ramped up, certainly, with the neocon agenda, basically, which is alive and kicking with Obama as well, because we all well know.
When I was looking at all these things and putting things together and trying to work out what I was going to talk to you about, invariably, I find it very hard to focus on things without shooting off.
Well, you can.
I feel that's
go off at tangents. That's okay. But you're not allowed to ask questions in this current climate. Mm. You know, you're not. You're not allowed. It's not encouraged at all. You're either ridiculed as a conspiracy theorist, or if you persist, it affects your health.
But what I was thinking about when I was thinking about that sort of Cold War and the nuclear threat, I then started, you know, I kind of was going off and then there's a thing where you say about mention Oppenheimer in the book as well, and an interesting thing was saying that when it was he's very famously quoted
from the Mahabharata,
saying the line from the Bhagavad Gita
for people who aren't aware of it. Robert Oppenheimer, developed the first atomic bomb. There was a lot of secrecy surrounding the Manhattan Project, and there was a question and answer period at one of the universities, and people didn't know anything about the Trinity Project or the Manhattan Project at that stage. And they asked Oppenheimer, they said, was the Manhattan Project, the bomb exploded on the Manhattan Project, the first bomb to be exploded, atomic bomb? And Oppenheimer said famously, well, yes, in modern times, of course. And then he started reciting from the Mahabharata. It was an incandescent column of flame that shone brighter than 10,000 suns. And he was off. Yeah. And of course, after that, he was discredited by the CIA, and he didn't do the hydrogen bomb project. That was passed over to Edward Teller after that. But the fact that you had such a great scientist, he could see that basically there'd been a nuclear war in prehistory, certainly recorded in the Mahabharata, and of course in the Bible with Sodom and Gomorrah, there's also evidence that there was a nuclear war in at one point on planet Earth in ancient times. Yes,
I think it's fascinating, because as soon as you look into that and you look into mythology and folklore, and it does seem to be very apparent that, you know, that there were these things where people were referred to as being gods, and it would just seem to be that actually they were just very smart and technologically advanced, and like the Tuatha De Danann that arrived in Ireland in shining ships, and then I think it was Nuadu that had his hand lopped off, and it was fine because somebody just made him one out of metal that worked exactly the same as a real hand. And then you suddenly go, well,
they didn't have metal then.
That's robotics, isn't it?
That's right.
You know, and it just seems that every culture starts to reference that.
Well, yes, forbidden archaeology. That's Michael Cremo is the person to talk to about this.
Yeah.
But he's a very famous person who's spoken about forbidden archaeology. Now, you know, when they discover ancient artifacts that don't fit into the orthodox chronology of history, they are ignored or sidelined, and this is really fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like this huge pyramid they found by the Azores that's underwater. Nobody wants to know about any more new pyramids, or the pyramids of Bosnia that are quite real that most people aren't aware of. People don't want to know about these things, and of course the media doesn't want to know about these things either, because again it doesn't fit into the accepted chronology of history. You know, that we are the apex of the pyramid, and all civilization has been a crescendo to this point, and we define the most advanced civilization. This bullshit.
But then it also, because it throws up a terrifying prospect that we think that we're just going to keep moving upwards and forwards, and that there's no, at no point are things going to, is it needed? Well, it is actually needed, that everything has to slow down or
well,
be
of course,
shopped,
all, everything. Will, our whole perception of our mankind's history will change once disclosure occurs.
Hmm.
Disclosure being the notion, when it is accepted on a widespread basis, that mankind is not alone, has never been alone, and that we do have. We do have communication with other civilizations from the stars. Certainly, Egdon Mitchell and other people in the Disclosure Project have revealed this. You know, one of the astronauts says we've made contact with people from the stars. What are we to make of this? When an astronaut says this, what are we to make of all the people in the Disclosure Project that talk about the UFO phenomena? So it's an exciting time, this 21st century. We will eventually, disclosure will come, and mankind will realize his place in the cosmos. And I believe that this is ahead of us.
I know that the people that actually entertain that as a truth, and I personally do.
This is exopolitics, yes.
Yes, because it then throws up the thing of everyone's like, oh, it will never happen because there'll be widespread chaos as people freak out as they have to reevaluate their entire lives. But then there's the thing about the idea that the media is drip feeding the idea and the concept of it to the point where, you know, you see so many science fiction TV shows, you watch so many films about outer space, that when it finally comes, people
that's
are just
right.
like, everyone's just like, oh, I knew it was going to happen anyway.
I think they've done all the tests. If you expose human beings to like a big shock, suddenly they find they're not alone, it would certainly have an impact on our global economy.
Yeah,
for sure. So I think that acclimatizing the population to the inevitable is been the right approach, really.
Yeah,
you know, people think you're mad. For example, to give you an example, my brother is a famous scientist.
Yeah.
Now, I could not have a conversation with my brother about the extraterrestrial phenomena. He'd say you were barking mad, and you know, I couldn't have a conversation with him.
But he's a particle physicist, right? Is that correct?
He's a quantum physicist.
My apologies. See, I find that quite surprising, because if you were to be dealing with these concepts that seem very alien to most people, that you couldn't take that into consideration, that in such a vast expanse of universes that there's just this.
Oh, my brother would accept the possibility of it.
Oh, okay.
But to say that
it's been happening.
That it's been happening for a while. I don't think you get more than probably 4 or 5 seconds before he left the room. Really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That must make for an interesting Christmas dinner.
Oh, now you hit on it. No kidding. You know, we kind of fell out over certain subjects, my brother and myself. You know, and I'll be honest about it. I mean, I'm a person, I believe my brother should ask questions as a scientist.
Mm.
And I'm still amazed that the World Trade Center 7, no plane hit it, and it free fell into its own footprint. Mm. And again, World Trade Center 7, it was announced on the BBC that it exploded 20 minutes before it did. How did they know?
Premonition.
You know, it's funny when we talk about these subjects, because I can just...
I find them fascinating.
I find it fascinating that everybody just goes all tight when you talk about the whole 9/11 thing, because it's basically like talking about Tibet and China, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, it's a no-no. Yeah. We're not encouraged to sort of question anything, you know.
I think now, though, that as terrible a place as the internet can be, I think it actually at times can be a force for good, and I think that those kind of questions are being asked repeatedly, and theories, perhaps not answers, being put forward.
But where it's going, I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I think that we're still living in a neocon agenda.
Yeah.
You know, basically, I think that we're on the verge of some kind of military action somewhere, because, I mean, all the resources on the planet have been quantified. And there's only so many resources there, and now it's a land grab, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, the corporations are looking at Russia and the Arctic, and Russia's current leadership doesn't want to work in harness with a unipolar world, and so it's creating a geopolitical problem at the moment. And I truly hope everything is going to be okay. But it's a very exciting climate to go to Russia in and invite Killing Joke's audience to come and join me in Russia while I record. Killing Joke's music with symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to having the ultimate Cold War experience in St. Petersburg. You know, on the 9th and 10th of July, we're doing the White Nights concerts, which is a floating stage in front of the Tsar's Palace. And you go on stage, the orchestra goes on stage about midnight, and all the audience are the other side of the lake, and the orchestra is kind of mic'd up through a big PA system, and it's an amazing, amazing experience. And the concerts start at midnight, and of course it's still light then, being the White Night concerts. And the president always turns up to one of the two big events of the year, classical events of the year, and then after this, I'm recording with St. Peter's State Orchestra, two really big works. The Killing Joke, symphonic Killing Joke, and then I'm going to do a violin concerto. And I think doing Killing Joke's music in Russia at this time, recording it over there, I couldn't think of a better background environment to record this music and to share it with some of the gatherers, some of the Killing Joke's fans.
Yeah.
In this recording experience, I'm so looking forward to it. I'm thrilled to bits about it. You know, it's great to be alive. So yes, so many of my the people I've seen in my career have passed on to the other world, and they're waiting for me in the other world. And but my time's not finished here yet. So I want to do as many concerts as possible with Killing Joke. I want to record as many records with symphony orchestra as possible, and to continue the work. I shall push Killing Joke until each album will get better than the last one. I swear, I promise. Each record will be more intense, more powerful than the one before. How is it possible 38 years later, you say, but it is possible, and we've been doing it. Look at the records we've recorded since the year 2000. They've just got better and better, and I believe the best is ahead of us still.
What was something that I found interesting the other day, I'm not sure if you're aware or if you're even bothered, but when I was looking on Spotify, and you look at the band and...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And the way that that works, you know, it will always put the top five songs or the most played songs.
Okay.
And Euphoria is number 4.
Is that right?
Which I found amazing. And,
is that right?
And quite a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. It is a beautiful thing.
Because it goes to show that with such a body of work that has gone across such an expanse of time...
You know, I'm going to do that in your 38th year.
Yeah. That not only is it relevant, but it's connecting as much as anything else from the past. There doesn't seem to be, like, you know, that kind of nostalgia with the band. I mean, there is, obviously, because of the legacy, but also what I mean is that the new works are viewed as
vital.
In the
same light as the old ones.
Yeah, as vital.
Well, it's a wonderful thing, isn't it? I mean, I really think that Killing Joke's got a lot to say. It's still, I mean, I'm excited about the next record that I do with Killing Joke because I know it'll be the monster of monsters.
Yeah.
And these records, the last three have just been a prelude to the next one. You know, working with Geordie, the longer you give him, the better it's going to be. And he comes up with chords and riffs. I don't know what planet they come from. I really don't. And, it's such a pleasure to work with this guy. It's going to be great orchestrating Killing Joke. So I can show the other three what great composers they are.
Yeah.
And it would be a big pleasure to conduct
and
it.
How long have you been working on that?
I haven't started yet. I start on Wednesday.
And then when's it going to be done? It's kind of all in mind.
I go around. You know what I do before I do classical music? I go from cafe to cafe. I take a little notebook of mine with me and I kind of dream, how should it be? How should it sound? And I just sit in cafes and I just imagine what it should sound like. And I make sketches and notes like this. And I do this for 3-4 weeks before I put pen to paper, always. And so I know where I'm going. I kind of dream it before I do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that was another thing in the book that resonated with me and struck a chord. And it's like I was saying at the very start, that this sort of discussion is something that normally happens later in when I'm having a talk with musicians, is the ones that agree that when inspiration is probably the most palatable way of saying it to some people strikes. You know, that can be at any time.
Sure.
And do you know what I'm saying? Do you know what I mean? And something in the book that struck me was when you were saying about, and you've said about your holy guardian angel and that concept, that when a voice tells you ideas, I don't mean an actual voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it is for some people.
When the spirit comes in, you're compelled to quickly get it down, quickly, fast, and then I do nothing. I stop, I sit there, and then when the spirit's on me, I go and do it, and until it stops again, and then I stop again. This is how the creativity kind of works with me, anyway. And I'll tell you my secret, and probably Geordie's secret. The best way to write great music is to forget all about music, and make your life colourful. Go to the places that you've dreamt about going to. Live out your dreams, and I think, when you start doing this, you've written the music inside you already, and you just need to download it. You know, so the best way to write music, forget all about music, and make your life beautiful, colourful, adventurous, and dramatic. You know, and these are the ingredients, I think, that you have to feed your soul with. You know, new territories, new landscapes, a fresh breeze blowing into your life. You know, these kind of things, they trigger different things.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because that's one of the beautiful things about being in a band, if it's having success, that you get to do those things, and yet it's almost as if, you know, that idea of travelling the world and experiencing cultures and places and people.
Look, we haven't always had success. We've had terrible times in our career. It hasn't changed anything. You know, we just stuck the boot in and gone on a straight line. Money or no money, the same thing's going to be done.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been that approach. I can remember in 1990, we couldn't get a record deal to save our lives anywhere. Nobody was interested in, and then you just keep going, and then it locks in again. Again, it's cliched, but a winner never quits and a quitter never wins, and it's true, because most of the people that you see who are successful many years on, they just haven't given up. And normally they're successful by default. You know, there's no one else there.
Yeah.
They've all died.
I think another testament to the band is the influence that you've had, and when you've got like these artists that have achieved great things and have made like great works themselves, and then will cite your band as being not only one of the reasons why they started making music, but have affected the way their own music sounds. That's got to be a gratifying thing, hasn't it? Or does it not bother you? Do you not even consider it?
I tell you, I will speak for my colleagues as well, we don't spend too much time thinking about that.
Yeah.
Everything that concerns Killing Joke is ahead of us.
Yeah.
Not behind us. You know, the things that interest us, and glories and those nice things where big bands play your music and those kind of things. Well, it's kind of nice, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's
all. Don't get to, you're as good as your next song, as your next record, as what's ahead of you.
Which goes back to the thing about, you know, with Euphoria being.
I think also poverty and hardships have made great music too.
Yeah.
With Killing Joke. I don't think Geordie's had it easy. And I know I certainly haven't had it easy with Killing Joke. And I think that if we got to a stage where we're too comfortable, I think our music would start to sound safe. So it's one of those things, but I don't want to be in a state of like of suffering and struggling all the time, but it's the way it seems to be. It's the way it's all about empathy, because you know, I know what it's like to be without anything. I know what it's like to be broke. I rarely have more than a couple of grand in my bank account. Rarely, and sometimes not even that. And so most of my friends, they don't have much work, and I see most of our friends generally struggling in this world to make ends meet. And these things affect all of us. And I think it's that sense of empathy with other people out there. They're struggling in this world. And Killing Joke, sometimes when I hear those tones, and the resonance of Killing Joke is the only thing that makes sense sometimes in my life. And I know that I can't live without Killing Joke. I have a need for Killing Joke.
It seems like such a dichotomy, in the sense that you know, you're composing residence in Prague.
Well, at the moment in Russia.
In Russia. And you write symphonies and concertos and then you play in a band as well. And I think it's such a beautiful balance, because it almost seems, in any other way, it would feel like they were at odds with each other because of, I don't know, maybe that's just my
opinion. No, it's because it wasn't planned like that. It's just the way it's landed.
Yeah.
And how wonderful it is too, because I really like the world of orchestras, and the audience is so different from everything with Killing Joke. And then the concert halls are so different.
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing, that whole thing of first, you know, the orchestra goes on, then the leader goes on, and the orchestra tunes up. The whole ritual, that's part of my life. Before Killing Joke, I did classical music.
Yeah.
And that was my life, you know? So it's nothing new. It's the classical music is very much part of my life. And I haven't given it enough attention over the last 10 years. But over the next 10 years, I'm going to absolutely dedicate myself to the symphony orchestra as much as Killing Joke.
And do you feel that they definitely complement each other, and you get, is it the same, do you get the same kind of thing out of each?
Oh no, they're completely different,
but they seem to be in harmony
with each other. Like, well, in the next 8 weeks I've got to perform with Killing Joke, and I'm also working with orchestra. But they don't really collide, because they're so different. They're such different areas of music, you know. No, I'm very lucky. But look, there you go. I mean, look, I'll be honest about it. Before I was 15, I had like 4 offences, you know, brushes with the law. And I looked like I was, you know, last time I went to court before I was 15, they were going to send me to Borstal. If I hadn't got in, pursued my orchestral career, then I'd have been in Borstal. I mean, things were looking pretty bad for me. And then when I consider everything that's come out of Killing Joke, which is, well, Killing Joke again is my university. You know, Killing Joke was how I managed to study symphony orchestra. I raised the money from Killing Joke, and I put that, what little I made, into studying orchestration. And so it's given me everything.
Yeah.
You know, the band has given me absolutely everything.
I think it's interesting as well, like you were saying about the ritual of when an orchestra is before a concert begins, the ritual of that, and then that I know that you view like gigs with Killing Joke in a ritualistic
absolutely
manner.
Absolutely, not just the band and myself, but the audience as well.
Yeah.
They know what we're up to backstage, and the whole thing of going to a Killing Joke concert is a ritual. It's one constant in a changing world. You know, a long career like Sugar Ray Leonard or anyone really, it's something that's deeply comforting, because it's one thing that doesn't change year in, year out. There we are, Killing Joke's playing at Hammersmith or wherever, and you can go, and it makes us, I don't know, we all feel better with each other. The ambience in a Killing Joke concert, I love the people, the audience that come. They're different to the individuals that go to a U2 concert. You know, for example,
the idea of treating a concert in a ritualistic manner is, I think, even if people aren't aware of it, I think there are certain bands that do it anyway, because of the energy, and it's a very primal thing. And most bands will say about thriving on the energy they get off of a crowd, and they probably only mean it in a, you know, in quite a glib way. But it is a truth. It is a real thing, I think.
It is.
And you can really feel it.
You see, you should be in a band too. Are you
in
a band? Well, that's good. See, it doesn't really matter at what stage a band is at. I think that everybody should be in a band. When I started my career, everyone was in a band. Everyone you met, all your mates, everybody was in a band. It was a huge renaissance. And just sharing music. Now only professional people make music, don't they?
Well,
I feel now that we're in a very good point of time, in the sense that it's almost like that punk rock ideal of, well, anyone can pick up a guitar. You don't need to be Jimmy Page. Everyone would love to be Jimmy Page, to be fair, and have his library, but not everyone can be Jimmy Page. But that wasn't a necessity. And that was one of the things that fueled punk. And I think now the opportunity for people is to make, you know, they can make albums in their bedroom. They might be dog shit, but they have the opportunity to do it, and they can use the internet to put them out there. They don't need a record label to do that. But I don't even know what I was going to say.
Yeah, but it was so. But now it's so eclectic.
Yeah.
And then because there was fewer choices, there was more of a movement. Now everybody's got too much choice.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's no movements.
Yeah.
But that works out well for Killing Joke. I mean, I don't care what state the music industry is at. The worse, the better it is for me. No one's doing what Killing Joke is doing.
I definitely think there's a few bands that that I would consider to be of
similar.
Not musically.
Outlook.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's the other thing that blows my mind is that you were a band that had that outlook long before a lot of other people did, and also achieved things that would never be able to be attained by bands with that mindset now.
Why?
I don't know. I think I don't know whether it was the time period. I don't know. You know,
they don't make human beings like that, again, do they? I mean, look at the individuality and the characters. Okay, looking from the 60s, the characters like Jagger, and just the individuality is not the same. There seems to be more of a personality seems to be more homogenous and normal, and not as exciting or animated as they used to be. Was it just my imagination that the characters aren't the same now, are they?
I don't know.
It's a different generation.
Individuality
doesn't play such an important role anymore.
I
don't think it does.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think we're moving to a time where they want to curtail people's individuality.
What?
And that's affecting art.
Yeah.
It's boring.
Yeah,
they're doing things that have been done before. There's no spirit of innovation. There's no experimental traditions nowadays. It doesn't seem to me like there's any real experimental schools with the music anymore.
I think there is, but I think it's coming from a different mindset, maybe. So maybe it doesn't have.
Listen,
that.
Listen, man, it's not working. It's a limp dick. It's not happening. It's not happening, is it? But again, that's good for us because, you know, I get together with Youth and Geordie, and I know we'll start making something, we'll go off in another universe. We just kind of jam until a monster is born, a musical monster. And it always happens. It's just a question of putting the right people in one room, then it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, another thing I wanted to brush on it, like if you're good, you know, all right, good, was that... again, going back to the ritualistic manner and also the your on stage, some people would say persona.
Well, I've never seen me. And I really go out of my way not to look at me through a screen, I have to tell you.
Because it does seem like that you do view it as it is very much an easier way, I would say, would be in a different mindset.
I'm just amazed how someone like me happens to be in this position. I don't know how the hell I got there. It was all one big mistake, and it went... But it's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's such a like a the idea of putting on either makeup or ash or whatever might be to
it changes my mindset.
Yeah,
for sure it does.
It is a mystical thing to put on a mask and take in this like archetypal character.
Yes.
of a jester. But wow. Jester makes it sound. No, that makes
I
it sound.
I remember going on stage and I remember coming off stage, but I can tell you I don't remember an awful lot in between.
Yeah.
Unless someone throws a can at me or something and it hits my head, or which hasn't happened for a long time, or someone spits and it lands in my mouth. That happened once. It was like a public execution when I got the guy on stage. Yeah. Oh, it was terrible.
That seemed to be the thing with punk, didn't it? I didn't get it.
Oh, it was disgusting in this way. I used to have to cover my keyboard with cling film because people used to gob on stage so much. I used to get inside the keyboard. My hands would be slipping everywhere. Oh, disgusting.
That is horrendous.
Disgusting.
I like the idea of this other personality, in a sense. I don't know that I'd necessarily like to hang out with him, but I like the idea of invoking this other spirit.
Well, it's like after a Killing Joke concert, I feel the better for it. I feel that I've bathed my soul in fire, and I feel cleansed, and I feel wonderful after a show. And I really do Killing Joke for spiritual reasons. Mm. And I really, because I wrestled with it for a long time. I mean, we did one concert back in 1980-81 in Hamburg, and there was about 500 people who couldn't get into the concert, and they smashed all the shop windows in the street, and it was the biggest fight. I mean, I've never done a concert where everybody in the audience is fighting. It's just like it's a soundtrack to absolute extreme violence. I saw about 1,500 people beating the crap out of each other. I never saw anything like it in my life. And we invited a record company that night as well, and they were standing right at the back of the hall watching this mayhem. And I remember after the concert saying to Big Paul, "Do you think we're doing the right thing?" I mean, I had real doubts about the Killing Joke was a force for good after that night. And I went through a period of time where I had doubts about Killing Joke, and then I realised it was a force for good. And I couldn't have continued if I felt that there was anything negative about it. But I remember that night, I'd never seen anything like it. Like 1,500 people all fighting. Normally you have one or two fights that break out, but I'd never seen anything like this, where it's thousands of people and they're just like laying into each other. It was like, it was really bad. It was really dark.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Why do you think that provoked that? Why do you think the band provoked that in
people? Sometimes it can just be like, I don't know, where the planets are that night. And, or pissed off people, and it kind of triggers, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure why it happened that night. We've never had anything quite as bad since, to be honest.
Yeah.
That was one of the worst ones.
Do you actually look at it that, like, in mystical terms when you're on stage, that there is this... that you feel like...
My brain doesn't work when I'm on stage. I mean, it switches off.
But do you think...
I'm not even there.
Is that being lost in the moment, or do you think it's something else?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I certainly feel different to my normal personality when I'm with Killing Joke. Something else comes through me.
Yeah. But
for sure it does.
Because I'd started, like, thinking about that and looking up different things, like in the tarot and stuff, and about the fool and the seeker and what he represents, and it all just seemed like certain things jumped out, just like it was just in the one book that I was reading, but
the fool is connected to initiation. I mean the word idiot means removing blindfolds. That's what the word idiot actually means. And for me, the fool is like it's an individual who's void. There's nothing there. It needs to be filled. That's what it is for me. It's the zero point energy of the fool. If you notice, for example, experts have very few options, but beginners have many options.
Yeah.
And this is a way I understand the archetype of the fool. Also, you know, and also, heroes normally die and fools survive, so it's a great archetype. And of course the Joker's headdress, that's the Hebrew letter shin, of course, on the headdress, and this is a symbol of the Holy Spirit, and they say that the Holy Spirit is present when people are laughing, and that means a lot to me too, because if you notice that when you laugh, there's no fear in your heart.
Yeah.
And that's why laughter and the term Killing Joke is something very sacred to me.
Yeah.
You know, because there's the absence of fear.
Yeah. It's funny you saying about you know, the three armed hat.
Yes.
Representing Shin. When I was, one thing that really jumped out at me in the book was when you were talking about the Pariri moth.
Yes.
And I thought, what an amazing thing to do. that you were, you would paint a tree with treacle.
Yeah.
And
I'm into moths.
To catch a moth.
Yeah.
And then house it in this area that would then attract male moths, and then they would breed, and then you would take the pupa away so that you could help propagate this
animal. I tried to do it every time I go back home. If I'm there for like 5-6 months, I try to do this cycle back on the island,
which I think is such a beautiful selfless thing. But then I started looking into that moth, and I don't know whether it's me tying things together, but I thought it was really interesting, because it was like I found out that like these are like my visual notes for the thing, and it was, I found out that the moth is obviously a representative. Well, it's the ghost moth, correct?
That's right. The moth is sacred to the goddess Mart.
Yeah,
and that's why it's special to me. But then
the fool card is Lamat.
Lamat also the connection. That's right.
And the other connection I made was, I mean, this might just be all bollocks, but I enjoyed it, was that I started looking up about the caterpillar or the grubs. They live for like 4 years before they then transform. And
it's
then
a pupa.
And they live for such a short time.
Because yes, the adult is a very short period.
Because the moth has no mouth, so
that's
it can't
right,
feed.
This moth has no mouth, yeah. Which the male has no mouth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because the tree that they have a preference for, and where they got their name from, is it the Puriri? Am I playing saying?
Yeah, you're right. Bang on.
In Maori culture, that is used in ceremony for funeral rites.
That's
And that tied in with the idea of the ghost moth as well.
That's right. And the Puriri moth is the symbol of the goddess of music, Hinirakatori, also.
Okay.
So it stretches right out. It's a very sacred symbol. And in occult lore, the moth is like the grasshopper, is associated with outside or exo forces, extraterrestrial forces. Yes.
Which then lead you to start questioning some of the things people talk about experiences with DMT. Do you know much about that?
I've never had those experiences. I've never done DMT myself, but I have heard this is, of course, what runs through your veins when you're dying, isn't it?
Yes.
Of course, and triggers very much the same experience at the moment of death.
But then people will often report like almost insectoid beings that they interact with.
Is that right?
Yeah. And the other thing about it is they originally thought it was the brain that made it. They thought it was in the pineal.
They did, yes. The pineal gland, didn't they? Yes.
But now, recent studies have said that they think it's actually the lungs which make it. Make me think about yogic practices with breathing and hyperventilation,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that's, you know, a link. But yeah, anyway, sorry, that's gone off.
But it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's truly fascinating.
But something I thought about with that moth as well, with the larvae, is it leaves a really distinctive shape in the trees. I looked it up, and it's like a distinctive shape, which is like the vav, the Hebrew letter, which is
vav.
Yeah, which is the letter for is it like for a channel or like a tunnel, almost.
Yes.
Is it one of the things it represents? So and it's almost like it's this visual representation of that idea, of like this transformation.
The moth is sacred to me because I used to breed moths as a child. I was a member of Worldwide Butterflies in Sherborne, Dorset.
Yeah.
And I used to have about 20 heated cages of caterpillars and butterflies and moths from all over the world, and I used to rear them and breed them and be part of this program, which kind of inspired me, which was to rear the common blue and Adonis blue butterflies and to release them in certain areas of Great Britain. I was part of this program when I was a nipper, when I was younger, so they kind of influenced my life later on, because you see butterflies and moths, the more diversity of species we see of them, they indicate the health of an ecosystem.
Yeah.
And so when there are none, it means it's fucks, basically.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the bee, really. I mean, we're seeing less and less bees, and Einstein said mankind will survive 4 years after the bee is made extinct. So, I mean,
I didn't know that.
That's where we are. That's where we are in our modern world, you know. I think about I think about like my children having children. I'm not a grandfather yet, but I'm sure it's coming. And the world that my grandchildren are going to inherit, somehow, we have space travel. We have all this fantastic technology. But what we need to do is we need to increase the bioorganisms that all life comes from, because the bioorganisms that all life comes from on our planet are becoming less and less and less. And at the moment, we get all our food from 1/300th of the planet.
Yeah.
1/300th of the planet Earth supplies all the food for human beings. And so we have to find a way how to turn this around, how to increase the microorganisms that are in soil. Otherwise, we're heading for extinction. And I can see why in the US and companies like DARPA think that the future of mankind is a transhuman future.
Mm.
Because we won't survive. Well, that's because we're destroying our planet at such an alarming rate that possibly the only option left to humanity is the transhuman future. Well, I like to challenge that.
Yeah.
I believe that we can increase the microorganisms, and we can create fertile oases all over the planet and increase food supply, healthy food supply. I mean, you know, I'm really worried about the future. You know, at the moment, you know, I don't know whether people are aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that's happened in the Pacific, but the equivalent that's going to happen here in the UK is called TTIP. And when this happens, basically, and it will happen, is you won't be able to know what's in your food, which is to say genetically modified organisms will be in your food, and you won't be able to do an awful lot about it. A bit like the United States of America. You wonder why obesity is so rampant in the United States of America. It is because, basically, Islam Siddiqui, who's one of the major lobbyists for Monsanto and DuPont and the rest of them, he was Obama's chief agricultural advisor. This is the guy that pushed for genetically modified organisms to be in Americans' food supply over the last 15 years.
Mm.
And we can see what's happening with the rate of obesity in America. That's coming here. Mm. That's coming to Europe, you know. And people won't be able to do anything about it. You won't be able to monitor what's going into your body or your children's bodies because of these trade laws, where you won't be able to advertise on the packet what's in the packet. You won't be able to say whether there's GMOs in there or not, because the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and TTIP has been penned, and the architects of this were the people who benefit. I mean, it's been written by Monsanto.
Hmm.
You know, and I really worry about the future of the world. I mean, for example, you're getting farmers now where genetically modified seeds are blown over into organic farms, and now they're being sued. Well, you can see what's going to happen next is they spray the air basically with nanoparticles. Different things are happening in our bodies as we speak now. There are nanoparticles in your body right now, and as they start growing, that's not yours. Somebody else has got a patent on that.
Yeah.
And so basically, what we're looking at in the future is human beings will be owned under patents by companies like Monsanto. This is their end game.
Yeah.
I believe this is their end game is to patent human beings. You're already getting people with Morgellons disease, where numbers are appearing in the hairs that are growing out of their heads. You should check it on YouTube. It's happening. Morgellons disease. Trying to see where this is coming. This is coming from nanoparticles that are being sprayed into the atmosphere. This is very real. It's no conspiracy theory, and it's happening now.
Well,
we can do very simple tests, you know, to tell whether there are nanoparticles in our bodies. Very simple. I've got a doctor who's prepared to do it. I'm going to do it quite soon, actually. I'm going to take a couple of doctors and show the world that we all have nanoparticles in our bodies. How they got there, that's another big discussion, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because then that throws up the idea about someone like Kurzweil saying that
Well,
Kurzweil's, he's basically involved with DARPA. It's already happening now. They're spraying the air with his nanotechnology that he's masturbating about. Kurzweil is creepy. Well, I don't believe in his ideas at all. I think it's sinful what he's doing.
It is creepy though, because it just seems like this whole driving motive for pushing forward with all these ideas is so that he can bring his father back to life.
He believes that baby boomers can be immortal. Kurzweil believes this.
Yeah,
He believes that he's going to be immortal. These kind of people, I mean. They seriously got just one half of their brain working.
Well, the thing is as well, is as soon as you start to look into that world and you think about the idea of AI coming into existence, which it is now already,
already making major decisions.
Of course. And then at that point, when's the decision made that it's like, well, this lot are just fucking ruining everything?
Of course.
Which sounds like a terrible script from a sci-fi movie.
I mean, science has become so deregulated. Mm. We're in a very, very dangerous state. And ironically, the only way to get out of this state is if we evolve towards becoming a one world order. It's the only way we're going to be able to decommission 459 nuclear power stations on the planet.
Mm.
Is if we have some form of global governance. It's true. It's ironic also.
Mm.
But then there's different models with that, isn't there? Yeah, there's the Rockefeller model, which seems to be a bit extreme. And then there's Gandhi's model of a Council of Nations, which is more appealing to somebody like me.
Yeah,
you know, I still believe in very much in tribalism, and I still believe that the tribal people of any given area, the indigenous people of any given area, are the best people to look after that area. So I'm not sure I believe in the idea of, new demographics, enforced migration and migration used as a weapon. It's all sad for me.
Hmm.
It's sad for me to see everything changing so fast, and these great ancient cultures being part of some sort of experiment of a think tank by subjecting them to other cultures and changing the demographics of whole regions like the European Union. No question it's happening in our European Union.
But when people kick against that, it's always the ugly side of it that rears its head, don't you find?
Well, it's difficult to say anything about what's happening now. I mean, I tend to feel a great sense of empathy with the migrants who are coming into Europe myself.
Yeah, of course.
I would do the same. I don't blame them in the slightest. What saddens me is suddenly we've got to this time in history where, when someone's coming to a lot of money, like, I don't know, Bill Gates or anyone who's successful, for some reason, Ted Turner, they feel it's their God-given right to be able to start talking about eugenics and who should die and who shouldn't die once they made a few bob for themselves. And I think this is sad, because what this is leading to is basically saying that human life has no value. I mean, certain people in think tanks, they refer to people who have no jobs or anything as useless eaters, and the whole way we look at human beings is we look at them as not, there's no humanity in our hearts left. There's no kindness left. There's too many people on the planet. Even Bob Geldof said this, and someone has to go. You know, so we're looking at all our planet, and we're saying, oh yeah, you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't be here. But that's basically what's going on, isn't it? I mean, in Australia, you've got solo mothers. They don't get their dole unless they take their had all their children vaccinated, and they're vaccinated. And you've got these kind of disturbing trends that are happening now. You get Bill Gates saying that basically if vaccines do their job properly, we'll have 20% less people on the planet. And what does that mean?
Yeah.
What does that mean? If vaccines do their job properly, we'll have 20% people less on the planet. Mm. What does it mean? For your brother's son or our children, I mean, what does it mean? I mean, depopulation is with us, isn't it? It's happening, isn't it? Everything from Codex to spray in the sky to putting fluoride in the water and then putting aluminium in the food supply so that we die of, well, it's a slow shutdown of the human immune system, aluminium fluoride poisoning. Yeah. And that's basically what's happening, isn't it? But they could keep the economy ticking over at the same time. I believe that's what's going on myself. I speak about loudly about these things because I feel it's the right thing to do. I tell you why I think it's the right thing to do, because my father brought me up this way. He said, you know, there was Hitler, and you have to speak out when you see these bad things happening, you know. When I see, like, why have they got like 900 brand new FEMA camps across America built by Halliburton with red zones and blue zones? Why have they got this? And they want this to be in all NATO countries. I don't like this trend. I don't like it. I don't like the militarization of the police force. It seems to be happening everywhere. Czech Republic, New Zealand. And this is all coming from the Pentagon HQ, you know. Basically, you know, get with the program. I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
But then that's a great reason for the band to still exist.
But as you can see, I'm still pissed off.
I think that's a good point to finish on.
Probably. Otherwise, you'd be stuck here forever. Well, it's been a pleasure, mate.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
So that was Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke. You should definitely try to pick up his book, Letters from Cythera. Current Killing Joke album, Pylon, is out. And the band are going to be playing in London at Brixton Academy on November the 4th, which I'm definitely going down to. If you could subscribe to Swim on iTunes, you can also do that on acast.com. But if you do it on iTunes, it means that you'll get the next episode the minute I upload it. And if you could leave a review on there as well, that would be beautiful and much appreciated. Next episode is with Sam Carter of Architects, and we're going to be talking about their new album, All Our Gods Have Abandoned Us, plus Sea Shepherd.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And a ton of other stuff as well. Thanks. I'm out. Peace.